loud enough, but I think you're broadcasting the audio, so I'd better ask to the microphone. So I hadn't thought about the distinction you had made, the structural versus the regulatory response we gave during the crisis, and bulk rule being the structural one. You're perfectly right, and that's probably garnered the biggest opposition among the industry. But there was another structural one, if I'm correct in my classification, that never saw the light of day, Lincoln Amendment, yeah. The swap push-out rule. Yeah. And that was also, that in a similar fashion to what Absolutely. You're proposing, it was going to at least push out the derivatives the holdings of the, you know, from the away from the depository institutions, yes. Still under the same roof, but in a different subsidiary. And that was eliminated before it could come into effect by the Republicans, which had control of Congress. So why do you think the same party that's still in charge of Congress, with now the president from the same party, will actually go for something that... I know they've talked about a 21st century Glass-Steagall, but by judging what they did with the Lincoln Amendment, why do you see that there's positive hope for now supporting something like this?
Very fair question. I think, well, first of all, that was done through the reconciliation process, which I really don't understand, except for the fact that it allows individuals to get stuff in the last minute and not have it debated. Had that been debated, I'm not sure the Democrats or Republicans in the majority, I don't know how they would have gone with that. But you were up against a budget, and so you went forward. So that's blaming whom, I'm not ready to blame in that. Number one. Number two, I think it was a mistake. Because even more than the Volcker rule, it did not keep the firm, the holding company ownership, from engaging in those activities. What it required is that they push it into the broker-dealer as a separate affiliate. Why didn't they want to do that? Because it raised the cost. Because you were outside the safety net, which is the whole issue with structure. And so if you can stay in, and that's why I say there are powerful forces to not separate. Otherwise, I think of the, well, you don't know, I'm speculating, as I said, but if you were to separate those out or to take the safety net and really narrow it down, then the case for separating out more activities builds, as I think you will capture value as you separately identify these institutions, as has happened in other breakups. That's why you do them. And not necessarily force them all the way out like Glass-Steagall, but get them away from the safety net. And with real separation, not a make-believe separation. So you have to limit what the parent holding company can downstream so it doesn't move bankruptcy up to the top and down to the other bank or vice versa. And you have to have enough capital in the industry so that when the one, I mean, the whole living wills process is about idiosyncratic failure, one failure. If you have five, you've got a crisis, and you're going to bail them out. You have no choice. So what I'm saying is you've got to separate these to where you can have a bankruptcy without it bringing all that firm down, or if that firm goes down, you have enough capital in the industry to absorb the shock, which we don't. Because if you look at the real capital in the industry, of the largest, that is, it's 6% tangible capital, loss-absorbing capacity. The regionals have more than 8%. The community is closer to 10%, and yet they're not the systemically important. So what you had in 2010, between the provisions and the actual losses, you had 6% that the industry had to absorb. That's its capital now. So how much confidence can you have in absorbing the shock? So you need more, you need to isolate, and then you let the market, you give more freedom to the market to innovate and to make mistakes and to hopefully have success. But right now, you know, we estimate that if you look at the, if 10% were the number, which it was before you had the safety net, it was a low end, all right, for the largest, 10% capital, tangible, loss-absorbing capital. If that were today, they have to raise about $500 billion as an industry. But that would absorb the loss. Now, if that's not the case, I mean, if we don't require that of them, then that's the taxpayer equity at risk. And would you like to know what the taxpayer's return on that is? Don't ask. Okay. So that's my point. Let's move it out. Let's let the market have more. Let's make the investor come up and absorb and take on the risk that they're getting the return for. And you think about it, if you were $7 trillion, if you're 30 or 40% of the GDP, to get your ROE up, it's going to take a heck of a lot of business development, right? Or lever. You get that nice boost. And I think that's where the incentive comes from, and that's why we need to break it up so that you... And I've said, you know, from where I was in saying bring Glass-Steagall back to let's make sure we have a holding company that has true separation, I think you gain a lot.
In terms of that separation, there's extremes. If it was totally separate, that would mean that it was like I own stock in the holding company, and really my stock was divided into two totally separate entities.
That's right.
In which case, there was no reason for those two entities to be joined in the first place. At the other end, they're using right. common platforms, right. common structures.
Bingo.
And then if they're using those common structures, how can you build an effective barrier from crossing over from one to the other? As soon as something starts to go wrong on the one side of it, it's the common platform right. that they're using that's going to be used to support the other. So right. how do you get that real separation?
Well, our proposal is that you have business lines, as we all know they do, and you break those out and you put tracking shares in. So now the investor makes a choice. They buy the tracking. They basically own the tracking shares, still with the holding company. And then you still have, if let's say that the customer is with the bank, you have super 23A restrictions. The bank cannot lend, nor sponsor, nor engage. So that's the restriction. But let's say that the customer needs some kind of global support. Let's assume that the customer needs some kind of a capital market support. They can go over to their affiliate. And there's real value in able to doing that, that customer and that the investors win, depending on how their portfolio is adjusted, and you have those synergies. So yeah, it does take some of the benefit. It does take away the benefit of low funding costs available through the safety net, most certainly. It does, however, leave the ability to have a business model that one can support the other. And legitimately. Now, tying arrangements and all those issues aside, and then you build real value. And I think you release a lot of value because right now the market can't price that stuff. They can't. It's all intertwined, and you're counting on, you know, maybe the subsidy on the commercial bank is actually being shared then with the capital market side of the business. You don't know that. But put them in separate, have them priced. The market knows it. Let's say this high-risk entity gets too far out, the market prices that. The bank over here, they see that. They might. It has its own sense of discipline. Yeah, there's other. There'll be. Should they have the same backroom office? Probably, in a very limited way. Okay, but they still have some of the synergies that they otherwise. So that's it. I mean, it's not free, but I want to tell you the cost of the crisis, despite the fact that they like to talk about having gotten their money back with a nice return that we underwrote, doesn't strike me as appealing because the economy took a huge hit that it's still trying to come back from. And I do worry about the fact that these are very large, they're more cumbersome, they're taking a larger share of income, but our economy is still growing 2%, and we see these things. These are issues that are intertwined with others, but they shouldn't just be ignored because they're intertwined with others, is my point. Yes.
Thomas, nice to hear you again. I have two questions that allow you to duck at least one of them.
I got to write down. If you get more than one, I can't remember the second one.
So I would like, what I found most interesting about one of your throwaway comments you just made was the regulatory regime, if you want to put it, the regulatory approach seems to be focused on the failure of individual institutions rather than a systemic crisis.
Right.
Right. And there are people like my good friend and your former colleague, Tim Geithner, who say sure. that's been a big mistake because we pretend, in some sense, that it's all about one big institution failing and not a systemic crisis.
Right.
You referred to that, and I think that was implicitly you were criticizing the structure for doing that, but as well. Then a more political question. One of the other regulatory approaches has been FSOC.
Oh.
And maybe you could share a few words on how you think that has worked and is likely, if I may put it, not to work in the period ahead.
Well, I'll take the first question. I'll probably pass on the second question. But on the first question, I think Tim Geithner's right. If you allow the industry to run with too little capital, you will have a systemic event every time you have an individual failure. I agree with that. The question is, should you allow the industry to operate with too little capital? And the answer to that is no. The market, if you did not have the safety net, the market would insist that you have almost twice as much capital, well, easily twice as much capital. It would insist. And then you can have that failure. I mean, Drexel, a broker-dealer, had more influence than Bear Stearns in its own right, failed. Anyone care? Anyone remember it? It was a bit hectic, right? It was hectic. But did the world come to an end? Did we bail out 19 banks at once or whatever the number is? No. And so we have to, number one, get the capital numbers right, which I just cannot, in my own mind, accept that we demand a regional bank or a community bank to have 8 to 10% capital. They're not. Anyway, they might all go bust at the same time, perhaps. But they're not in the sense of an individual failure bringing the entire system down. But these largest do. And they keep telling me, Tom, you're gonna hurt economic growth. Well, capital is not a reserve. Capital is a source of funds that you lend and you get a return on, number one. Number two, study after study now is coming out showing that it does not impede growth in any, and the cost benefit is clearly to the benefit to have more capital. And yet, we assert that it'll hurt growth and therefore we can't do it. I think we should. And so that's where I think the regulators, and remember now, we have a lot at stake, so these firms are going to argue strongly, and I don't blame them. If I were in their shoes, I might. Although I think, given the history, banks with better capital tend to have nice returns and good premiums, by the way. But I understand, and I think we need to understand that better and more broadly and bring those capital numbers up. As far as FSOC goes, it does provide a forum for meeting and discussing issues, and it does provide a forum for putting pressure where there seems to be weak spots. And I think in that sense, it is not a regulatory agency in and of itself, and I don't know that it should be, frankly. I mean, duplicating one, I'm not sure is necessarily beneficial. So is duplicating the FDIC and the FSOC in terms of decision making, I don't think necessarily is useful. But I do think it's good to have at the highest levels a common forum for discussion. So, right here, young guy. And then we'll head this way.
Thank you. I was interested to hear what your position on cross-shareholding between investment firms and just industrialized firms as a regulating factor specifically. I know it pertains to the Japanese miracle post-World War II. They followed like a zaibatsu system that had that banking element. The same with Germany post-World War II.
Yeah.
And modern day Korea to a certain extent. So
yeah.
If you could comment on that.
Well, I'm happy to. I, sometimes I think I'm a throwback or something, but I see nothing but trouble with commercial firms having ownership of commercial banks. Nothing but trouble, especially with the safety net in place. Because, you know, I see it today. I'm not a fan. I'm on the record. I'm not a fan of industrial loan companies being owned by, name a company, and there's plenty of them, with deposit insurance. So think of it as a firm. Okay, so you have a major firm. It has a commercial bank. It has some customers. Now, they're going to swear they have a Chinese wall. I mean, they're on their mother's grave. They will swear they have a Chinese wall until that sale has to be made and they need some financing. Then you get conflicts. And I think one of the beauty of the United States' success has been the separation, where you make an objective credit decision or capital markets decision for an industrial commercial firm, and we prosper. When you start getting conflicts and you make the oligarchy even stronger, then I think you pay a dear price. So I don't, and when you have insured low-cost funds, I mean, believe me, you haven't deposit insurance, your funding is lower cost than if you don't. So now you've got, now, what about the competitive effect? So you have three firms. One has a commercial bank deposit. They work it now, they don't, and so you have them lending, and the other two don't. Who wins? So the other two have to get into the business. Who wins? And over time, when the crisis comes, who loses? So I don't have, I mean, you know, Adam Smith, two things. I mean, we all talk about his invisible hand. But he had much more to say than that. He was not in favor of mixing banking and commerce, my reading of it. He has this wonderful quote, you know, the goal of business is to broaden the market, narrow the competition. Broaden the market, okay, narrow the competition, we all pay for it. And that's what I think we should also be mindful of. Right over here, yes. Right there. She's bringing them.
I may be reading, Harold Hastings from Simon's Rock, I may be reading too much into your remarks just from saying them at the same time, but you spoke about an increasing share of earnings going to the financial sector and a decreasing growth rate in recoveries. Decreasing growth rate. And do you think this is more than a coincidence or a correlation, or am I just reading too much into this?
Well, I didn't raise the question just to be raising it. I don't know the answer, but I think it should be looked into. Because, look, it'll be a tough question, right? Because growth is affected by so many things. But it is, you know, bothersome that they're the winners, and then you have this kind of stale growth model going forward more broadly. Now, is that due to tax policy? Is that due to monetary policy? Is that due to a change in the culture? I don't know, but I would like to see some research on it. I don't think we should just assume it has no relationship either. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm encouraging this wonderful research institution to research. Yes, right here, young guy.
So after the financial crisis, great advances were achieved with Dodd-Frank in both capitalization and liquidity ratios for financial institutions. But there was also a great advancement in terms of the orderly liquidation system being established so that the government could take over these failing companies and make the liquidation more timely and efficient, which obviously we would have wished had happened with Lehman Brothers. But now there is an ongoing debate within the Republican Party to get rid of this aspect of Dodd-Frank. And I wonder if the capitalization and the liquidity ratios that were implemented have made the financial system resilient enough to be able to successfully survive without this orderly liquidation system being in place.
Well, here's my views on that. I'm pretty convinced that given the capital levels of the industry today, that you would have a difficult time without having a systemic crisis should any one of these largest fail. I think, however, we can, if we deal with that, if we get the capital numbers up to where they can absorb this shock of one failure, or God forbid, two, then you can, with the proposal I have, separating them out, you can have a bankruptcy. It won't be orderly, because bankruptcies seldom are, but you will have a systematic process in the sense of how you go through bankruptcy, how you file the courts, how the creditors are treated, and access, and so forth. And it has a greater discipline on the market itself. So that would be the goal. However, unless you have that goal, then I think you're going to have Title II whether you want it or not. Okay? So you might as well have it where it's systematic. But I would be very supportive of getting rid of Title II if I had confidence that you could go through a bankruptcy. But I'm not confident at that. These institutions, the numbers I gave are basically the gap numbers, okay, the general accounting numbers on terms of the percent of GDP, $7 trillion, so forth. But if you take the derivatives book of these, trillions of dollars of notional value, fair value in one institution, another trillion on their balance sheet under an international accounting system. So that means that $7 trillion is probably low. So you're going to have this industry that needs more capital, so you're going to have systemic immediately. It's going to overwhelm the economy. You've got to step in. I don't care. As strong as I am on wanting to have them go through bankruptcy, strong as I am on wanting them to separate, if I were the Secretary of the Treasury, I'd bail them out. Do you really want to be known as the Secretary of the Treasury that sank the world economy? I don't have that kind of, I don't have that kind of guts. And no one else does either. Yes, and his reputation is, it never ends, does it? He's known as let them eat cake melon. Okay, yes, right here. To your right.
Just following up on your proposal to have a tracking stock and creating different subs at the bank holding level, given that banking is global, how would your proposal be harmonized around the world, given the capital flows where the returns are highest?
Well, that's a very fair question. I think if you do separate them out and they have to manage, they're going to manage differently. I think that in bankruptcy, you will have effects. And I think, you know, I think one of the great issues ahead, because, look, I'm telling you, I think we want to cooperate on a global basis. Basel is very important. The FSB is very important. However, if you really go in and you see the differences among the countries, it's not one size fits all. It is very different. And so I think it begs the question going forward of whether you will have subsidiarization on a global basis. Whether if the U.S. firm wants, they set up their separate affiliate and some do it now in the U.K., in wherever it is in Europe, and capital, and it's going to require more capital. It's called pre-ring fencing, for lack of another description. Go ahead, follow up.
The other thing I've observed about banking is that given that they have giant teams of lawyers and accountants, they're pretty awesome at regulatory arbitrage.
Sure.
So how do you get around that? Is it more complexity, or is it just to simplify things that they're just so transparent?
Well, if you're saying given the regulatory path they're going to win, if you say given the regulatory path we're on now and they're going to win, I'd probably say yeah. But if you do separate it out, and yeah, they're going to work on arbitrage, but if the market is pricing it, at least you have some greater transparency, you have a chance of success. But I want to tell you that the amount of, look, it's unavoidable. It's not good or bad. It's just the way it is. That today, with the regulatory, you know, the living will process. I mean, I call it, the amount of wealth being created around that is enormous. All right? How I deal with it, how I arbitrage it, how I make sure. I mean, it's the regulatory process is very labor intensive. And the market process, look, I'm not saying it's great. I'm not saying it won't make mistakes, but it does correct with the harshness. And if you have a structure that can absorb the harshness, then it learns. And that's why capitalism is so successful over the decades, over the centuries. It's not because it's, you know, it's somehow foolproof. It makes terrible mistakes, but it corrects it, and therefore you get more and better outcomes. That's my argument. Now, only time will tell. But when I see the growth rate of the economy going down, demographics taken into account, then I do think we ought to think about a different proposal. Any others? I think I've worn them out, Jan.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You haven't worn me out, but I think I've worn you out. Thank you.